The following programming is sponsored by the law firm of Soloff & Zervanus. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Legal & Labor Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We are sponsored by Soloff & Zervanus. We've got a fantastic broadcast. I'm here with my co-host, John Zervanus. John, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you, Joe.
I'm ecstatic to bring into the program PA State Senator Sharif Street, who is also the chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party. Senator, how are you, sir?
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
We're fantastic. We appreciate your time. We know you're busy. Obviously, lots going on here in PA. We just had an election, a judicial, the primary, the PA primary, literally yesterday. And, you know, I'd like you to make an assessment. John, you were bringing that, you wanted to talk about that. Make an assessment, about, the election yesterday. And of course, we got a lot more coming in the fall.
Sure. Look, I think people overwhelmingly spoke out in so first of all, in Philadelphia, the district attorney, Larry Krasner, won. The majority of the folks endorsed by Democratic City Committee were won as well. I think all but one of the judicial candidates. So one thing I'd say, the Democratic operation in Philadelphia remains very strong. And that's one thing that there have been some questioning, you know, is the Democratic Party, a city committee in Philadelphia still strong? And the answer is overwhelmingly yes. The second point is, about the district attorney's race. And Larry Krasner won big. And I think he won because people, generally speaking, liked his policies. People in Philadelphia, believe that we need to have less mass incarceration, and crime is going down. And if you can, and when you lock up less people, you save money. It's good for the economy. And the reality is that we are safer than we were. And I know that Judge Dugan's going to make a different case, but it's kind of hard when crime is down, murder is down about 36%. Violent crime is down over 40%, and I think people felt it, and they felt that D.A. Krasner was doing a good job.
One of the things that you know, is always interesting, as individuals, you know, the three of us on this broadcast, obviously passionate about political process. We're it's like Christmas Day election day. I don't care if it's a primary or not. But what's interesting about it is, you get to your polling place. I think we had 20% across, I don't know if it was across the state, but so many people, you know, if it's not, a presidential or a mayoral or gubernatorial, election, they give it a pass sometimes. And, the judicial races are so important. Okay. And talk about that, you know, the turnout and the fact that, you know, I mean, people and the importance of judicial elections and people should, kind of engage a little bit more, because you're more likely in many cases to come in contact with a judge than you are, obviously, the mayor, a senator, a congressman. Talk about that, if you would, Sharif.
Well, look, first of all, a judge is the only person who is an individual has a right to take away your children, take away your property, take away your liberty. And people don't think about it that way. But a single, if there's a dispute, you come before a judge. The judge can say, you know what, that house, it's we're giving it to this person or that person. A judge can say, we're going to garnish your wages for the next, 6 months or 5 years, 10 years. A judge can say, because of what your conduct, you have to go sit in a cell for the next 20 years. Or a judge could say, your children have to be removed from you, or you can only see them during these time periods. So many of the most fundamental things that people are, that impact people's daily lives, are things that a judge can do. A lot of people say, well, I'll never be in court, and so I don't worry about it. And then you have that family who something goes wrong, with mom or dad, and they get the wrong medical procedure, and they're lost, and now they're looking for a modicum of justice in a tort suit. That's the courts. Or there's a dispute. You get in a fight. You think the other person started it, but now you found yourself charged, and now you're sitting before a criminal judge.
Sure.
You're a union organizer. This is a union show, and you're picketing, and you're standing on public property in the public right of way picketing, and a guy who owns the business says, "Get out of there," comes here and tells you to leave. There's a shoving match occurs. This happens all the time. And if you're not careful, you get the wrong judges. All of those union organizers will get charged with assault, disorderly conduct, trespassing, and things like that. When we know that picketing is a protected right of political speech, and so whether you have good judges is important, but almost everybody, black, white, old, young, Democrats and Republicans just don't come out for those races.
Sure.
Because there isn't as much money spent. They're not as sexy as who's going to be congressman, who's going to be mayor, who's going to be the president. The people running tend to be more professional in terms of jurisprudence. And so they don't give, most judicial candidates aren't as eloquent or funny, you know, as people running for legislative office. And so, you know, you just don't get as many people engaged. Too much of our public wants to be entertained by politics now, as opposed to just picking people who are best to govern.
Absolutely. Jonathan.
I would like to just add to that, that the judiciary is more important than a lot of people realize. Not only because you might not expect to have to go before a judge in a courtroom or ever, hire a lawyer to represent you in a civil case or defend you in a criminal case. But more importantly, the judiciary kind of goes, we lose sight of this, not me, because, you know, we're lawyers and we recognize the importance of the judiciary. But, you know, the public has to really appreciate the equal powers that our forefathers created amongst the branches. And, you know, if you lose the independence of the judiciary, the citizens aren't going to realize what happened to them. And a great example of this is, you know, Christine Noem was asked the question, what is habeas corpus? Okay. And granted, more people than not probably don't know what it means, but it's probably the seminal, point and most significant part of our Constitution, if you really want to think about it. Your government can't just pick you up and lock you up. Habeas corpus means they have to be accountable for why they're locking you up, and the person's getting locked up or being confined gets to challenge them in court. And, you know, it kind of is, you go along with the due process idea. You know, if you don't have habeas corpus and due process, we don't have a democracy.
Sure, exactly.
And who's going to call out the executive branch and the legislative branch? Who's going to call them out? All we have left is the judiciary. And an example being, you've got federal judges now standing up to an executive who is probably overreaching in some cases. And, you know, you're looking at they're like the last stop.
Sure.
And a lot of that crowd isn't happy, but, you know, that's where the public has to realize how important the judiciary is.
Right, no question. Without due process, we're not America.
No, we're not.
So I know the senator only has a few minutes. One of the issues, John, you wanted to touch on something that's important, especially as Democrats here in Pennsylvania. Obviously, it's on a federal level, but if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it's been in the news, and I know Senator Fetterman has he had a challenging election because of his stroke and so forth. And, you know, to his credit, he's made a remarkable physical comeback, but there's been rumors out there that he hasn't been compliant with medication, and potentially it's affected his behavior and mood swings, and probably a delicate issue for you. But I was wondering if you could comment on that. And I'm trusting he intends to run for re-election.
Sure.
So, one, don't know if he wants to run for re-election or not. That's not for four more years.
Okay.
That'll be a decision that, John Fetterman, his family, and his political team have to make. Two, in the short run, he hasn't broken the law in any way that would stop him from serving. So he's going to remain our U.S. Senator unless he decides to quit. And then three, John Fetterman is the only one in a position to he and his doctors and family are the ones that know what's going on with his health. But what I can say is that it is fair for the public to ask questions. We are public figures and the public has a right to be concerned. That being said, ultimately other elected officials, we don't get to pick, when he should leave and when he should stay. And right now, we're working with him. If I call him, he'll talk to me and, we try and I think given what's going on with the president, we certainly need to be working with as many folks as we can.
Absolutely. No question about that. You know, when you talk about, obviously it's been a crazy world lately to say, and you mentioned the words due process, John, and that's on the front page right now. Okay. Mm-hmm. With the mass deportations and all that. I want to stay a little bit in Philadelphia though. I mean, in Pennsylvania, Senator, if you will, worker classification, there was an announcement, misclassification. I apologize. Worker misclassification and workers' rights. Obviously workers' rights have been at the forefront what you stand for since you became a political candidate. Talk about what's going on in developing legislation to strengthen PA's workplace misclassification.
Well, there's a few things. We as Senate Democrats have offered legislation to strengthen worker misclassification. It's an issue that's super important. And unfortunately, Republicans in the legislature make speeches about moving those bills, but haven't actually done it. They won't move the bills. It's a problem because to highlight it, the Senate Democratic Policy Committee recently held hearings in Philadelphia, right over at the Laborers Training Center, about worker misclassification. And what do we want to do? We want to make sure that workers are not misclassified because it hurts those individual workers that are not adequately compensated. Two, the government isn't collecting the amount of taxes it needs, which go to fund roads and bridges, which go to fund police officers, which could reduce the total amount of taxes that need to be paid by law-abiding citizens who are paying their fair share. So there are a number of reasons that it hurts because a lot of those people aren't insured, so it can increase the amount of uncompensated care that hospitals have to provide. There are a number of things that can happen when you don't have when you have workers being misclassified, and this is something that Republicans have been paying lip service to dealing with, but just quite frankly haven't been getting it done. Look, if they're going to do it, then they need to do it. It'd be good for everyone. If they're not going to do it, you can't let them play in the face of organized labor and working people by pretending that they're going to do something to get votes and then never deliver it.
Yeah, you're talking about situations where individuals are being classified as subcontractors, yet they have to be in at the 7 o'clock every day. They get the same lunch. They get they're staying. The end of their workday is all at the same time. And none of them are getting benefits. Okay, and so. These are situations, like you said, Senator, you're detrimental to the tax base, okay? And not to mention, all of their rights as workers. And we've been talking, obviously in labor, we've been talking about this a long time. And so it is extremely refreshing, obviously, that to hear that's at the forefront of the agenda. You've talked a lot about jobs in PA. What is on your agenda along with that? That's at the forefront right now.
Well, one, we're going to try to got to get SEPTA funded. Mass transit funding is super important. We want to fund our roads and bridges in the southeast and in the southwest and in many parts of the Commonwealth. There are lots of people that move around and on buses and trains. Right, and I'll tell you, in the southeast in Philadelphia and its suburbs, without SEPTA, our roads couldn't even accommodate all the cars. Traffic's bad enough. Can you imagine if you put 800,000 more people who ride SEPTA each day on the road, as opposed to being, in cars, as opposed to being, on trains and buses. We wouldn't even be able to accommodate them. The gridlock would be brutal. So we gotta need to fund mass transit. We're looking at, and we're getting closer to getting cannabis legalization done. And we want to make sure that's done in a way that small businesses and disadvantaged folks, can participate. And I want to make sure that there are labor peace agreements in whichever cannabis legislation we get, because in a multi-billion-dollar industry, we should make sure that the workers have the right to organize and that there's fair dealing between workers and the employers. We want to continue to make sure we fund education and crime prevention programs. Those are things that are really important. And we got to make sure that we protect our healthcare system. We got venture capitalists that bought up Hahnemann and shut it down. Then they brought up Chester Crozier, shut it down. And we need to make sure that venture capitalists don't just try and destroy our healthcare system for a buck.
Absolutely.
So we need to protect our healthcare system as well.
Yeah, I mean, what happened at Hahnemann Hospitals is really it's one of those things where you're shaking your head, and how didn't we see it coming in a lot of ways in the individuals' profits. So, and when you're dealing with a situation like that, when you talk about the venture capitals, you're talking about profits over patients.
Well,
yeah,
John, you talked
a second time when they did it at Crozier Chester, which is terrible.
If we want to protect our health system, one of the things that is probably forefront is protecting Medicare and Medicaid, because hospital systems live not so much on private insurance, but most of patients are on Medicaid and Medicare. And if you don't have a federal system that's paying those bills, the system's going to collapse. It's not going to just be Hahnemann and Chester Crozier. You're going to have a hell of a lot of other systems that are going to collapse because there's no money coming in. And that issue is another issue that's very, very important. And folks have to appreciate that we have to keep that working. I'm not sure what the answer is, frankly, other than maybe we shouldn't give tax cuts to the enormously wealthy at the risk of these federal programs. But it's bigger than that, and I'm not sure what the answer is. And the state senator and the folks in Harrisburg and Washington have to figure it out.
No, you're exactly right. We can't give tax cuts to the super wealthy at the expense of Medicare or Medicaid. There are three people. When you looked at the value of the tax cuts to three people in the Walton family, three people. You could save, those folks were saving $31.8 billion, it was suggested.
Did you say B, billion with a B?
$3 billion, yes.
Wow.
So $31.8 billion annual tax break to just three people.
For three people with the proposal that's on the table now?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a travesty of justice.
It's incredible. And how do you, And you're going to put Medicaid at more risk and Medicare at more risk. Well, we already know it's at risk. I don't understand it. I just don't understand it.
Well, they want to give $1.3 trillion in breaks to the super rich.
Yeah.
No question. Well, listen, Senator, we know your time is limited. We got about 11 hours left here of stuff that we could talk about, but we really do appreciate your time, and we appreciate your insight and what you're doing every day for Pennsylvanians across the Commonwealth, and certainly now more than ever, we need leadership like yourself, okay, to help us get through what's going on. There's so much in jeopardy right now, and we really appreciate your time.
Appreciate you as well, my friend.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I want to thank Senator Sharif Streed for being our guest on the program.
Absolutely.
We're going to have more in just a minute.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America.
I just don't think my family would be as happy as they are without the support that I received from Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Go to PVA.org to learn more.
Hi, I'm Kelsey Grammer. Wounded Warrior Project supports injured veterans by connecting them with fellow warriors, by serving them through mental health and wellness programs, and by empowering them to live on their own terms. No one should face a battle alone. Join us at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Heart attacks and strokes don't stay home. When seconds count, call 911. The hospital is the safest place to be. Visit heart.org/don't die of doubt. Brought to you by the American Heart Association.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Legal and Labor Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We're sponsored by Soloff and Cervanos. Shout out to Senator Sharif Streed for being on the broadcast in the first segment. On a second segment, I'm ecstatic to bring into the program a couple great friends of mine and leaders of labor in the city of Philadelphia. Butch Bennett, who was the business manager of the Philadelphia Building Trades, or assistant business manager to Philadelphia. I did that the last time, didn't I, Sharif? I mean, didn't I, Butch?
You're trying to get me in trouble.
I know. I'm looking.
We definitely got a boss, and his name is Ryan.
I know. Of course, we can't let him hear this broadcast. And of course, Brian Ettis, business agent of the Philadelphia Building Trades. Brian and Butch, welcome to the show. So, guys.
Thanks.
So, you know, obviously we're coming off an election, a judicial election, and we're going to talk about that. But to kind of, you know, lay the groundwork, you know, as individuals, assistant business manager and business agent for the Philadelphia Building Trades, talk about, you know, what your day looks like on, you know, what your main objectives are every day and what your jobs are on behalf of our union community. I'll go to Butch first and then Brian.
Yes, sir. Well, Joe, first of all, thank you for having Brian and myself on to discuss these important matters for your listeners, because some of your listeners are most of our people who don't get a chance to talk to us and probably don't understand what we do as representatives. I don't want to speak for Brian, but both of our jobs are very similar. We go and try to entice new clients. I mean, we got our regular clients like the Penns of the world, the Mercks, the Drexel Universities, but we try to appeal to other end users and clients that our workers are the best in the world. They're the best trained. And we challenge the people that own these projects to come to our training sites. If you don't take our word, look how our people are trained. Look at the training sites. Those training sites are multi-million dollar facilities that get upgraded every year, and we're just the best. So we just try to do our best to maintain the work that we have with the friends that we have, again, like the Mercks of the world and the Pens and the Chops of the world. Just to talk about this briefly, I talked to Donald Moore, who is the senior vice president of real estate for Chop. I told him today, I think going forward, I think we need to put PLAs in place because when different trade unions have contract issues, you don't have to worry about any stoppage due to a contract issue. So I think PLAs, which we always talk about on your show,
and we're going to get
are in play.
And we're definitely, that's a big part of our conversation. Brian, if you'll jump in.
Yeah, sure. No, and thank you. Like Bush said, you know, we appreciate being on the show. I think we would need like an 8-hour segment.
Right.
To really explain all the things that we do from day to day. but I'll try to sum it up in one sentence. You know, our responsibility is really about increasing the market share in the area that the Philadelphia Building Trades cover, which is the five counties of southeastern Pennsylvania.
And what's interesting about that, okay, and you know, when you so if you're listening to the broadcast, okay, what's really interesting is, okay, the building trades covers the five counties, okay, and Philadelphia is a staunchly union town, okay, and you know, we're embedded in the culture of Philadelphia. We, you know, obviously our labor community has a rich history. But both of you gentlemen, you handle the counties as well. Okay. And so when you talk about going out and representing, the Philadelphia building trades, okay, in Philadelphia, of course, but also in the surrounding counties, you know, it opens up a whole new ball of wax. Okay. Talk about that, if you will, and because people listening may think, well, we understand the market share that the building trades have in Philadelphia. We are the strongest union town in America because of our great leadership, like you mentioned, Ryan Boyer and everybody at the building trades, and of course at the AFL-CIO as well. However, okay. When you get to the counties and you get out there, that both of you guys are selling and promoting and advocating union labor, okay, to individuals that don't know as much about it, okay. So it's not just something I want to let the people, want that to go over their heads. Brian Ettis, talk about that landscape. And not just the challenges, because, but just talk about, the landscape and what you face on a daily basis.
Yeah, I appreciate the question, Joe. And like you had mentioned, yesterday was election day.
Yep.
And yeah, I didn't get home until about 10 o'clock last night. And first thing this morning, we had a meeting, at 8 a.m. with a developer / general contractor by the name of Bart Mallow, and I have a real bad echo right now.
Well, we actually, believe it or not, your echo is not coming through to the broadcast.
That's great. That's good to know. So anyway, we were talking about a $2 billion project up at the Ferrellis Steel Mill, where they've faced everything from manpower questions. And that's never been an issue for the Philadelphia Village. You know, anytime we've ever been asked to provide manpower, we've always answered the call.
Let me ask you a question in regards to that. What seemed to, for those individuals out of the, you know, who are bringing projects in or who may be from out of our jurisdiction, what are the, the concerns that they have, and what are the things that they don't know about us that you educate them about, so that, especially when you talk about project labor agreements, what do they need to be educated on?
So when they hire the Philadelphia Building Trades and our members, they're getting the best value. We're second to none, best trained, highly skilled. And we always finish projects on time and under budget.
Butch, if you will jump in there.
I guess me and Brian are showing that we're joined at the hip. Because I had this conversation earlier, and I was explaining to, again, Donald Moore, who I was talking to, when you have a PLA, one thing in our world, in labor's world, that we know about is the bottom line is the bottom line. And what I mean by that is the owner of the project doesn't get hit with change orders. When you deal with the non-union, I don't care where you go, they always have change orders. And I would challenge your listeners, if you had any contractors, developers that have been in that world or ventured into that world one time or another, they know exactly what I'm talking about. There is always change orders. Now, I was privy to be around some of our really big contractors recently, and I asked them, I said, how many times that you can recollect that we've been on projects, major projects, that got hit with change orders? And they all seemed to, like a uniform, said, none. I can't remember any, but So that's to our credit that our job, not only do they come in safe, because that's the most important thing of all. When you go to work with 10 toes and 10 fingers, that's the way you're supposed to come home.
Exactly.
So not only safety about the project, but the project comes in on time and on budget. That is the key. And that is so major.
And having said that, you mentioned PLAs, okay? But we've also talked about RCOs, okay? What is the difference?
Sir.
What's the difference between an RCO and a PLA?
Can we take that, Butch?
Yeah, we can both bounce off of that one.
Yeah. So I want to say it was three years ago when I started my role with the building trades, and one of the challenges that we had faced were our contractors weren't always looking at projects out in the counties because they were getting beat on prevailing wage projects. They were getting beat by 20-30%. And for our contractors to get to the table and estimate and, you know, spend money on the project, they need to have an opportunity to win that job. And we already know going into it, you're going to get beat by 20-30%. It's really discouraging for them to bid a project like that. And I know for me, you know, I only work in the counties, and I'm very competitive. I want to make sure that we get on as many projects as possible. So one of the ways that we can level the playing field to make sure that the other contractors are following the rules, you know, we saw a success rate with the responsible contracting languages where you can guarantee that the people working on that project have gone through a Class A accredited apprentice program under the, you know, responsible contracting ordinance, and that started to attract more contractors to go out and bid. And we've seen, you know, and we've had studies that have done that have shown that when you have an RCO in place, that's a taxpayer protection on construction projects because you're guaranteeing that you're going to have a skilled, trained workforce.
Yeah. Just to
piggyback off what Brian is saying, RCO, Responsible Contractors Ordinance, is what it is. You want a responsible contractor. And our friend Brian has brought this up, and we started addressing this some 3 years ago. I can't speak for all of what the area that Brian covers, but I know they got a ton of RCOs. We were successful in getting 23 RCOs in Delaware County in a three-year span, which is unheard of, with the building trades have never, ever done before. And that's the guarantee that we try to give our contractors, like, look, we've got these RCOs in these townships and in these municipalities. Come on out here and bid the work. It'll be a level playing field for you because, like Brian just alluded to, some of these guys, they knew they were going to get beat. They just didn't bid it. So now we have relationships with these municipalities and school districts and procurement departments that are letting us know that, like in the county, Anthony Moss is the chairman.
Yep.
So we've been finding out that, hey, we've garnered a relationship where they'll tell us, hey, look, you don't have any of your contractors bidding this stuff. Can you make a couple calls and get guys a bid? So more recently, like Brian alluded, in the past 3 years, we've been able to get the Hunter Roberts, the Keatings, the T.M. Wards, the Domus, P. Agnes, all of them to come out there and look at these projects. BSI. BSI is on the biggest PLA project Delaware County has seen in years, and that's the George Hill Prison.
Sure.
And we're working on the Silvercare PLA right this minute. I talked to Cleary, me and Anthony talked to Cleary about 10 o'clock this morning, getting everything lined up. We already gave the client the generic PLA. They gave it to their law department, and we're waiting for that to come. But the PLA and the RCO are joined at the hip. We love a PLA, but if we can't get it, we'll settle for the RPO.
And you know, you talk about our apprentice programs, okay? And we do individual shows about them, okay? And we'll touch on them just. But I mean, the education that our apprentice programs provide in labor are second to none, okay? In the Philadelphia building trades, routinely our workers are coming out with associate's degrees, okay? And those programs are also paid for by our unions. But what the beautiful thing about it, and guys, I'm just going to jump into the conversation and let me know if I'm off base here. But fact of the matter is that because we have such a great educational program, okay, and because we have such skilled labor, you never can have to run out of work. Or we have if for example the flu hits the job and seven guys are out, you can get seven guys that day who are just as skilled and educated. And so it's one of the advantages we have when it comes to and you talk about the safety programs. I mean, Brian, you mentioned you run into these projects where you're going to get non-union bidding 30% less. Let me say this. With the skilled workforce that we have and the guarantee that there's no job shortages and the workforce and manpower we have, it's in my opinion, it far makes up for the risk. Any thoughts on that, guys?
The one thing that I do want to add, and Butch had mentioned earlier, about Joe Cleary, at one of the last or previous business managers meeting, he had let the rest of the managers know that we had done an internal study among all the trades, and the Philadelphia building trades invest $60 million
yep.
into our JATC programs collectively across the board. So that's money that is all part of our CBAs, our collective bargaining agreements, that we reinvest, back into our training, through our safety and our apprenticeship programs, which is, again, there's no comparison. There's no other organization that I know of that spends that kind of money into basically educating and training our apprentices.
Absolutely. And they're not government supplemented. These are paid for strictly by the members, which is a fantastic thing. And that's such a big part. Hey, we talk about it in education all the time. Not everybody, wants to go to college a lot of people's aptitudes are in the arts and now in labor, and of course, and in college as well. Guys, we're going to finish up on the political conversation. Okay. Yesterday was an election, okay, and obviously it was a judicial election, and it's an important one, okay. Brian Edish, you want to give us a little bit of an analysis?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the unfortunate part, for Philadelphia, we'll talk about the citywide average in turnout for voting was under 15%. It was like 14.6% or so. It was a competitive district attorney's race. You had 9 court of common pleas judges that were up. There was 3 municipal spots that were up. And to, follow a presidential election where, I live in the 63rd ward, in Northeast Philadelphia, we had over 80% last election cycle, to go under 15% is just really discouraging and frustrating in a lot of ways. And like you had mentioned about, judges matter. A lot of times, they make decisions that, affect your life, and it could be life or death at times.
No question about it. That's right. And so we're much more likely to encounter a judge than we are a senator, even a state rep or a mayor or a governor. And so it's why it's so important that people understand, get out there and be a part of that process. One of the things that happened, obviously, this is a very volatile environment, right now out there. We talk about, what's going on in America. Okay. And labor is on the front lines, and Brian Boyer has said, said it 100 times. If you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Okay. And in Washington, we are on the menu. Okay. Almost. In other words, they'd like us to be on the menu. okay? We, you know, we back down and to no one, and obviously our leadership is what carries us through, okay? But I say it all the time and educate, you know, and I know you guys do when it comes to rank and file members, the importance of voting, you know, your leadership, voting, you know, your paycheck, and yet some rank and file members have crossed that line, okay? And, you know, and you know, in some cases, you know, it puts us in jeopardy. John, you wanted to say something on that.
I just wanted to ask both of you, there's the theme behind, and I'm sorry, we might be making a turn here that is going far and away from where we've been going. But the theme behind tariffs for the longest time, or at least since it's been in the news since quote-unquote Liberation Day, is that it's going to bring jobs back to America, and somehow in some convoluted fashion, it's some effort on the president's part to support labor. But when you peel back the onion and you see that many American products, the final American product is oftentimes includes foreign component parts, and especially in the auto industry and a lot of other industries. And it's going to drive prices up. And of course, if prices are driven up, the concern, of course, is that demand's going to drop. It's a simple supply and demand kind of argument. And if demand drops, you're going to have people on the street because you're going to have layoffs because you're not having enough people buying because they can't afford it.
Or building.
Yeah, or building. And you're going to – that's going to affect labor. And my frustration has always been – and I had this conversation with Butch months and months ago. I guess it was before the presidential election – is although union leadership oftentimes supports and historically they've supported the Democratic Party because Democratic Party has usually supported labor and so forth, and I'd like to know what your positions are concerning the tariffs and what feedback are you getting from your rank and file? Do they believe that tariffs may in the long run affect union jobs negatively, or they really believe that industry is going to come back like it did in the 50s and 60s, which that economy, by the way, doesn't exist anymore?
Guys?
Well, just from what I've – conversations that I've had and – conversations that I've been engaged with, full disclosure.
Sure.
Our membership seem like they just going with the flow. Not all of them, but a great deal of them just seem like the guy that occupies 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue can't do no wrong. And it's crazy because, before he even got real engaged with the tariffs. He talked about them during his campaign, but after he was sworn in, I think he got sworn in, what was it, that Monday or that Tuesday? We have a $3.5 billion project slated to come to energy transfer down in Delco.
Sure.
The problem, the project didn't get scrapped, but it got put on hold. The minute he took power, I got a call.
And how does rank and file not see that and say, uh-oh?
Brian Edis, jump in there.
So I'm no economist, but when you slap a tariff on something, that's an increase to cost. And if we're talking about in the short term, because last time I checked, I think we get the majority of our steel and lumber from Canada. If they want to slap a tariff on something and they're an increase the cost, that does not help production, like you said, John. That does not help. And, our members may want to, believe and hear things that sound good to them about, keeping jobs here. But there has to be effective and insightful plan in place in order to be able to execute that. And that's not going to happen overnight. And for them to believe that that's going to help us, you know, in the short term, it would be extremely short-sighted of them.
Absolutely. And one of the issues there, first of all, I don't think people really understand. I can't say I do. Understand, you know, tariffs, you know, the intricacies of them. It's not quite as simple. And so a lot of times, and I was just watching something, you know, so we're on location at John's office while we're doing this broadcast, and the farmers are going down. In other words, they're, you know, certainly a lot of the, you know, the tariffs are the benefits of them are not, they're not getting them as soon as they need them. And so, you know, no question, obviously, and a lot of rank and file members, and God, we're, you know, we're so proud of our rank and file, but, politically speaking, and I know you guys are on the front lines here, you know, educating everybody on the importance of understanding, you know, what impacts their paycheck and what impacts, you know, our labor community. And of course, like John Zerfano said, okay, projects, okay, that, you know, I mean, if they're not building, then, and at the end of the day, and I've said this 100 times, you know, if you don't vote your paycheck and vote your, you know, your unions, and by the way, guys, you know, better than anybody, we've crossed, you know, we can't just work on one side of the aisle. And I can tell you that the first day, the labor show used to be on Wednesdays. And so the first time that Trump won, we had a show planned. Obviously the elections are on Tuesdays. So Wednesday we had the show. Okay. And, the guys that I forget exactly who the labor leaders we had on were, but they, it was such a shock to them that they couldn't do the show. So we brought on Pat Iding and Rick Blumendale. And the first thing they said was, you know, okay, we're going to get through this. And Brian Ettis, you've said it also on previous broadcasts when we talked about that was right before the presidential election. Okay. So, I mean, in other words, one way or another, we get through. So one of the things I think Rick Blumendale and Pat Iding said was that labor's not a political party. We support those who support us. John Zerfano's, you're right. Obviously, we align ourselves well with the Democrats because the far right Republicans are constantly trying to, you know, throw right to work legislation and decimate our collective bargaining.
Yeah, but if you've got a president that's selling and marketing himself is there for the everyman.
Oh yeah, and he's not.
And he's not. He's just not. And there has to be. I'm not there. I'm not in the union halls. I'm not there talking about this stuff with the rank and file. But I don't understand how if you're a guy working on the docks in Southern California and there's no shipments coming in from China and you have nothing to do, you don't have a job anymore. And that's a direct result of tariffs. But yet you voted for that guy.
Yeah, well,
I don't get it.
Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting point because tariffs are one thing, but also the right to work legislation and the history there.
Oh, yeah.
Guys, you know, we only got a couple of minutes left, but, you just touch on that, you know, in regards to, you know, the constant passion to educate our members on voting. You know, I think one of our labor leaders recently said, the first time Trump came in, when I asked him, I said, what do you think of what's going on with Trump? He said he's exactly what I thought he was going to be. Okay. We all know how he treated our union contractors when he was in. By the way, now, you know, now that these situations are coming to light, like, Butch, it's interesting you said that. Are opinions changing for anybody who voted for Trump or you know, what is the sentiment right now? Butchie?
So what we have, Joe, is between Brian and myself and the committees, Brian and myself created a group text. When we first got at the building trade, we said, how can we communicate with everybody in one shot? So we did like the young, like your grandkids and your nephews and nieces do.
Sure.
They have a text where everybody's on the text. We did that. So we send out in this group text any information that comes out what this president is doing to hurt labor.
Sure.
We send it out And then in that, we asked the agents, send these out to your steward.
Sure.
Send it out to the guys that are on the job. So our people can see this stuff, at first hour. Like, they don't need to see it two weeks later, three. They need to see it in live time.
Sure.
So that's how we try to communicate. And again, when we go on these job sites, I was just on the proton, therapy, project. That's a $1 billion project down in, West Philadelphia. I went on there, what's today? Today is Wednesday, Monday. I was there Monday and I was talking to some of the guys and one of the guys had a Trump sticker on his hard hat.
Jesus.
I said, you do realize that if Trump had it his way, you wouldn't even be working on this site.
You'd be out of business.
Because he would want to get rid of us. Oh, well, I'd still be working this business. I said, yeah, that could be true, but you wouldn't be making what you're making right now.
Yeah.
That's what we deal with. Like,
why is it so difficult? Why is it so difficult for them to understand this? I don't get it.
I think it's some underlying stuff there, Drew. And that's okay. Another comp for another radio show.
All right.
But I do think it's a couple of reasons why people kind of side with him.
I never thought
I would see our country looking like this.
Well, I also think it's the media they're watching in a sense. And of course, thankfully, we're not talking about all rank and file, but it really, to me, any rank and file has to educate themselves. As we hit the road here, guys, I want to ask Brian Ennis. Brian, we have the Supreme Court retention coming up, in the election in the fall. You want to just address that?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you bringing that up because it's extremely important. It was 10 years ago where Pennsylvania, for the first time in over 300 years, had three vacancies on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And, the amount of resources, effort, and energy that went into getting those three justices elected, Kevin Dougherty, David Weck, and Christine Donahue, and I actually at the time had ran Kevin Dougherty's campaign and knew what was at stake and what was on the line. And the fact that we're up for retention is just, a little wild because it's been 10 years since then, which it seems like it was 5 years ago. But this time around, it's a retention election where it's a yes or a no vote at the bottom of the ballot. And typically it's not something that you would need to pay much attention to or worry about, but we did have one example, that I can remember, Russ Nigro during the legislative pay raise where he was actually not retained. Now, there's been a lot of talks about the amount of money, resources that are going to go into it. I haven't heard anything concrete yet, but we have a unique opportunity to retain those three justices, and it's probably the most important retention election of our lifetime. As a matter of fact, it is the most important retention election of our lifetime, so we need to do everything in our power to educate our members. And like John had said, it's sometimes frustrating, but it's nothing new. It's nothing new for people to vote against their own self-interest because they get caught up on wedge issues. And, before that wedge issue could have been abortion. This time around, maybe it's, men and women's sports. And people hear that and they're immediately turned off.
Immigration is a hot topic, obviously.
Yeah.
Absolutely, immigration. Absolutely. So there are certain things that people hear and it drives a wedge, into the poor middle class folks, the people that we represent. And you get one half of the working class fighting the other half of working class, and it divides us. And that's where we lose our power.
By the way, just so you know, Kevin Dougherty was our guest last month on this very broadcast, and so he, we were talking about the potential politics. And I think you'll both agree when you're talking about Supreme Court justices, you should be able to run on your record. Politics should never get involved, but there's been a lot of talk about the barrage of dirty politics that could come against our Supreme Court justices that are up for retention. What do you think about that, Brian?
Well, again, the possibility of threat is there, and we got to be prepared to make sure that they have all the protections. And if it was based off of their record, there wouldn't be any question. They've done an amazing job in protecting people's rights, you know, and doing a fantastic job as serving, you know, as a Supreme Court justice. And I really believe, I'm confident that they'll be okay. But again, you know, you hear different things from Elon Musk to Jeffrey Ash investing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. I think it would be a waste of money. But if they do and they decide to do that, I think we need to be prepared.
Absolutely. Well, listen, gentlemen, obviously we appreciate your time. It's been, you know, obviously we could go another 5 hours, but, and because there's so many, topics to talk about, but, want to thank, Brian Edison, Butch Bennett of the Philadelphia Building Trades for joining us on the program. John Zervanos, any parting words, sir?
I'd love to figure out how we can address wedge issues, but that's the low hanging fruit that gets everybody stoked. And we got to figure that one out.
Absolutely. Well, listen, guys, thanks for joining us. On behalf of John Zervanos, obviously, we want to thank Senator Sharif Street, Butch Bennett, and Brian Edis. I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.